Hello and welcome to Inside Education. We're online at insideed.com. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on this week's programme.
Professional development is a limited resource, and the principles for making decisions about what PD you select should be based on these elements that are important in the landscape and not just on what's convenient for you or what your favourite hobby horse is.
Professor Suzanne Wilson from Michigan State University shares some of her insights and ideas about professional development for teachers. But first, as always, we go to Barry Hennessy for this week's education news. You're welcome, Barry.
Hello again, Sean. Well, lots happening at the moment as the new academic year gets into full swing, but we'll turn our attention first to the debate around reform of third level entry, which this week was given something tangible to consider with the publication of the Hyland Report. In her findings, Áine Hyland, a former professor of education at University College Cork, presents a detailed overview of the current Leaving Cert, the points system, and the concerns that students who come through the system are not sufficiently prepared for higher education. Research carried out since the 1970s has consistently found that academic performance in the Leaving Cert is a reliable predictor of student performance in higher education. This is particularly the case with regard to English and maths, but the relationship isn't entirely linear, with factors such as gender and field of study also playing a role. The effects of poor performance in maths at Leaving Cert are seen in the higher than average dropout rates in technology-related disciplines in higher education. In terms of her findings, Áine Hyland presents a menu of options which will first be considered at a symposium organised by the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment and the Higher Education Authority next weekend. Her suggestions come under three main headings: decoupling selection for higher education from the Leaving Cert, using other selection mechanisms in addition to the current Leaving Cert, or varying the existing selection system. Professor Hyland herself acknowledges that the first two options will be very difficult to implement, so most attention is going to focus on her ideas for varying the existing arrangements. Among the more plausible suggestions made are the setting of realistic minimum entry requirements for each course, requiring students to take Leaving Cert subjects that are relevant to the intended course of study, and the counting of subjects relevant to the course in question for points purposes ahead of less relevant subjects. Overall, though, the Hyland Report probably best illustrates the real difficulties involved in tinkering with a system that is generally regarded as fair and transparent, even if it isn't perfect. Some of Professor Hyland's suggestions, such as random selection for qualified applicants or allocating places to the best performers in each school to combat disadvantage, would seem very unfair towards hard-working and high-achieving students. For his part, Minister Rory Quinn has said he has an open mind about Professor Hyland's proposals and that any changes brought in would need to enjoy public confidence. The annual Congress of the Irish Vocational Education Association will be held in Cork this week, with many VEC representatives feeling that their sector is being disproportionately affected by cutbacks in education. The order paper for the two-day event is dominated by concerns over the expected wave of retirements due to hit schools and VEC offices and the non-replacement of posts of responsibility. The Congress will also debate a motion calling on Minister Quinn to review the pupil-teacher ratio for DESH schools and restore supports under all programmes. There'll also be calls for an increase in VTOS and post-Leaving Cert places in the current academic year to deal with significantly increased demand for places in further education and the removal of the €200 charge for these courses. Needless to say, the prospect of an early positive answer to any of these demands is practically nil, given that the budgetary process depends hugely on the results of the Comprehensive Spending Review and Minister Noonan's promised multi-year plan, both of which are due in October. But VEC delegates will certainly be hoping that a Labour minister will grasp the desirability of safeguarding resources in the most disadvantaged schools in what we all know will be a very tough December budget. Sinn Féin has called for the immediate implementation of the EPSEN Act in order to ensure that children with special educational needs are educated in an inclusive environment and achieve outcomes in line with their abilities. In all, 23 education motions were passed at the party's Ardesh in Belfast this weekend, dealing with education issues in both parts of Ireland. Not all motions were critical of the current government's policies. Delegates welcomed the change to the Leaving Cert Irish exam from 2012, under which 40% of marks will now go for the oral test. They called for a grant scheme to support students travelling to the Gaeltacht and additional staff and study materials to support the teaching of Irish. The junior minister at the Department of Education and Skills, Kieron Cannon, is visiting Malaysia and Singapore this week in a bid to shore up the already significant educational links between Ireland and the two countries. In Kuala Lumpur, Minister Cannon is due to sign a bilateral agreement with the Malaysian Higher Education Ministry, which aims to develop linkages in the areas of biotech and green tech. Over 1,500 Malaysian students currently enrol in Irish universities each year, contributing more than €43 million to the economy here. Irish universities are also popular with students from Singapore, the bulk of whom, like their Malaysian counterparts, come here to study medicine. The Irish government aims to double the number of international students coming here to study by 2016. And that's this week's Education News, Sean.
Thanks for that, Barry. And Barry Hennessy will, of course, be back at the same time next week with more education news. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, insideed.com. You can contact the programme on 086 8962 665. That is 086 8962 665 for your text messages. On a previous programme, I spoke to Professor Suzanne Wilson about pre-service teacher education. This week, I bring you another interview with Suzanne Wilson, where she talks about professional development for teachers. Suzanne Wilson is a distinguished professor and chair of the Department of Teacher Education at Michigan State University. Her current work focuses on developing sound measures for tracking what teachers learn in teacher preparation, induction and professional development programmes. In today's interview, Suzanne talks about teaching methods that are used by teachers of history and geography. She talks about the carnival of professional development opportunities for teachers and the power of social networks as part of professional learning. Her own background is as a social studies, history and geography teacher, and I began by asking her about the specific teaching methods that she likes to see beginning and experienced social studies teachers using. The Deborah and Pam that she refers to early in the piece are Deborah Ball and Pam Grossman, who featured in recent Inside Education interviews.
I, like Deborah and Pam, am very interested in this issue about what would you pick as the things that beginning teachers would need to know, as opposed to thinking about things that maybe more experienced teachers can take on. This is, of course, complicated because you don't want to have them become conservative in the way they think about teaching. So you don't want them to master a small number of conservative strategies and then be closed down toward learning more ambitious ways of teaching. So some mix of things like what are the standard things that social studies and history teachers do? They have to be able to tell a good story. History is full of good stories. They have to do something about being able to tell a good story. And one might think about that as a form of lecturing. So there's something about learning to master the lecture, doing that well in entertaining and substantively rich ways. Discussion is a very big part of, should be a very big part of social studies classes, and learning how to manage a discussion and prepare students to engage in a discussion is very important, so I think that's another one. Doing something with primary sources or with, if you're in history, or with the texts that are part of the discipline, so sociologists use different kinds of texts, anthropologists, psychologists, so whatever it is that the social studies content that you're learning, some kind of what Lee Shulman might call a signature pedagogy for that kind of inquiry would be also an important part. So learning how to use primary sources for a history teacher, or learning to help students do observations of cultures for an anthropology teacher. You would want to have some kind of practice that was associated more with inquiry in the field that they felt comfortable enough with to use in their classroom. I think those are three. There are others, but I think those are the three main ones.
And you spoke there, Suzanne, about not wanting to overburden beginning teachers with too many ambitious strategies. But presumably then you believe that they will get the more ambitious strategies through professional development. Can you say a little bit about the relationship that you see between pre-service education and in-service education for teachers?
Well, my empirical observation is that there is no relationship in the United States between these things. This is a problem, and we have two different kinds of professional development. We have the early career support that's called induction, and then we have the big amorphous mass of everything else for all other practicing teachers called professional development. We do, I think that there are very good examples of professional development that have been designed and are at play in parts of the country. One feature of the professional development landscape, though, is that teachers are free to select what it is that they come to what they participate in. So I've just finished a paper where I call this a carnival, where there are lots of different kinds of booths that are available for teachers in terms of professional development. And some of them are things that are sort of, it is like a carnival. Some things are sort of tacky, some things are cheap, some things are, you know, good, some things are poor, and no one is holding the teacher accountable either for the quality of the things that they select or the degree to which one thing builds on another. And so there tends to be no depth built over time, unless a teacher is what some people would call a professional development junkie and just goes to, on his or her own, one thing after another thing after another thing. I think ideally, one of the things that is in the spirit of our program is that we have all of our interns in their fifth year write a professional development plan for themselves in around the break, around January, where they identify where they think their core areas of weakness are and how they plan on developing their knowledge and skill in those areas. And I think ideally you would have all teachers developing some sort of plan for themselves where you were holding them accountable to different kinds of texts for making decisions. For instance, the curriculum that they were teaching and an analysis of how their content knowledge or their pedagogical skill mapped onto the demands of that curriculum. State policies, either curricular standards or assessments, and what they as a teacher needed to be able to do in order to teach to those standards or analyze student data or evidence in schools or something like that. And so you could hold on to the autonomy in some ways that teachers had for selecting their own professional development, but you would at the same time say, but we're professional development is a limited resource, and the principles for making decisions about what PD you select should be based on these elements that are important in the landscape and not just on what's convenient for you or what your favorite hobby horse is.
But isn't that such a challenge then for a teacher, if you're asking a teacher to take on responsibility for themselves? Because most evaluation, as you have pointed out, is of professional development is based on what the teacher thinks of it rather than on whether or not it changes their practice, even less so whether or not it affects student learning.
Yes. And I'm studying a professional development program right now, which I think is lovely and a nice combination of teachers not really having autonomy, but teachers having a lot of having the professional development nevertheless being relevant and teachers being respected as professionals in it. So this is at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, and the AMNH participates in something called Urban Advantage with eight other cultural institutions in the city, the Botanical Gardens in Brooklyn and the Bronx, and several other museums and the aquarium and the zoo. And there are educators at all of these institutions, and these educators collaborated with the New York City Public Schools on the standards for the school system for science. So they are familiar with what the teachers have to teach in the schools in New York City, and they're committed to that because they helped work on them. And they designed professional development for all the middle school teachers in the city to support middle school teachers learning how to do scientific inquiry themselves and how to teach scientific inquiry to students. And then schools sign up. So a principal will sign up to participate in Urban Advantage. And then all the teachers in the school eventually end up in Urban Advantage. It used to be that just the volunteers would do it, but now the city has invested in this so much that they're trying to spread it to all the middle school teachers. So in this way, they've identified something that's part of the part of the curriculum that's new, that we know is a weakness of most teachers. Most teachers do not have deep science. Elementary or middle school teachers have extensive experience with science. They certainly don't know how to do inquiry in science. If they have had any exposure to inquiry in science, it's been a very limited sort of school version of the five steps for doing a scientific inquiry and not doesn't have the diversity of if you go to the Natural History Museum, you learn how to use secondary resources because you're studying rocks and dinosaurs and things like that, and they're not something you can go out and observe, move. And if you're in the zoo, you're doing field work, and if you're in a botanical garden, you can actually do an experiment because you can grow things. And so the teachers learn a range of different kinds of inquiry. They are treated like learners themselves, and they're not treated like kids learning science. They are brought to the museum to learn how to use the museum and the resources. And then they go back to their schools and they think they get support from the program about how to translate what they've learned about doing inquiry themselves into supporting their students in doing inquiry. And then a requirement in the school system is that all eighth graders in the city have to do an inquiry project in order to graduate from eighth grade. And so the Museum of Natural History actually holds an exposition of 300 inquiry projects of New York City kids that have been picked as exemplary ones. And they take over the entire first floor of the museum for a Saturday or a Sunday in May. And all these children and their parents and their grandmothers and their sisters and brothers and their teachers all flood the museum, have poster presentations and explain their inquiry, and their teachers are there with them. So this is an example of where teachers are given a lot of latitude because they're taught how to do inquiry themselves, but they're not left completely on their own, but they really have their own, they make their own decisions about what to do with their students. But there's a citywide investment in this, deciding to build the capacity of teachers in New York City to teach science better. So that's different than, you know, leaving it up to teachers, not having it aligned to the curriculum necessarily, but it still has the American flavor of autonomy because we're just not going to abandon the egalitarian ideal of we get to make our own choices even if it has a pathological effect on what teachers might learn.
And is that project that the eighth graders do, is that seen as a way of evaluating the effect of the professional development?
We're using it, the research project that I'm doing is using it as one of the measures. So we have other student under, we have a lot of this has to do with whether or not the sixth through eighth graders who are the students of the teacher's classes are learning how to think about the nature of science differently. So we also have assessments of changes in the students' understanding of the nature of science that we're using in this research project. And then we're also collecting all these inquiry projects so that we can look at the differences in the qualities of those projects. So that's the anchoring student sort of learning data. And then we have measures of the teacher's understanding of the nature of science and the teacher's understanding of the particular topics that they've been learning. So they're learning about zebra mussel migration in one of the American Museum of Natural History projects. And so we have assessments that are about zebra mussel migration and the food chain, because those are particular topics that they're learning. And we're interested not only in whether they change their ideas about how you do scientific inquiry, but also whether they learn the substantive concepts that are part of the PD. So,
Suzanne, it must be about 8 years now since California Dreaming, your book was published, which I loved, about the maths wars in California. And with this kind of distance now, what are the lessons that you take out from that book for professional development? What did observing the teachers and their attempt to, and not just the teachers, but the policymakers' attempt to change mathematics teaching, what lessons did that give you for professional development of teachers in mathematics or in any other area?
That's a good question. I think the power of social networks as part of professional learning, I don't claim to be a sage to be able to look into a crystal ball, but my own observation of how interconnected the teachers were to one another across the entire state through the professional development opportunities that they went after and through their going to professional meetings were very important pieces of the stories that they told about how they learned mathematics over time. And that, I think, has researchers have picked up on the power of those of social network theory in understanding sort of human capital development when they think about the educational system. And I think that still that holds, and I think that's one of the things that projects like this American Museum of Natural History project, even though it's not part of their theory of change, you can see that what they're designing is a network model of teachers meeting one another, having joint work. They might meet at a, they go from one museum actually for the first half of the PD, and they end up then going to another museum. So they develop a connection with maybe the Bronx Zoo, and then they develop another one with the Brooklyn Botanical Garden. And this idea of being in a network of people who have an identity as science educator, just like in California Dreaming, it was so important for these mainly women to have these identities as mathematics educators, and that those networks both help them do the sort of informal work of continuing to work on something over time, because a lot of your learning, as Deborah Ball and David Cohen once said in one piece about teaching and teacher learning, most learning that teachers do is in their classroom on a daily basis. It's not in professional development. Teacher preparation is a very short period of time. Mostly what happens is what happens with them alone in a classroom, and figuring out how to create opportunities for teacher learning that leverages that daily practice, that daily opportunity to learn, I think is really important. And these social networks do that, just like that I used in California Dreaming, that example from the book on social cognition and the Xerox technicians, and how the Xerox technicians would meet at this cafe and talk about the problems that they were having with particular machines and places. And it was at the meetings in the coffee shop. It wasn't the manual that had been developed to help them figure out how to fix the machines that was important. It was the informal meetings at breakfast or at the bar after work where they exchanged their knowledge. And if you create these networks, then there are opportunities for both formal gathering but also this informal gathering. And I think that is something that people have really continued to try to bear down on. And of course, in this age with all this social networking with technology, there's even more possibility for that.
So these sound a little bit like subject associations where teachers teaching a particular subject meet. And how do they get off the ground if they're not already in place?
I think they get off the ground either because people go to the statewide professional organization. So NCTM, the National Council for Teachers of Mathematics, has the California Association for Teachers of Mathematics, the Michigan Association for Teachers of Mathematics, and many times either elementary or secondary teachers who have a fondness for a particular subject matter will join their local subject matter organization, and then they'll expand their range of interest to the state, and then sometimes they start to go to the national one. So they have, through formal allegiance with or affiliation with a professional subject matter organization, they have a ever-expanding circle of people who they can connect with and pick up ideas from and go to conferences with. I think they also, because there's this landscape, this carnival of professional development, they sometimes go at it, they get hooked in through picking a professional development project where they meet somebody who's in some other kind of network already. So they hook up with someone and they find out about this other opportunity, and then they find out about this other opportunity. So I think either they get in through these professional associations, or they get in serendipitously through going to a professional development opportunity where they meet other people of like mind who then get them to come to their meetings.
See, what I'm wondering about is it something that has to start from the ground up with teachers, or is it something that a policymaker can say, I'd like to get these social networks off the ground, and I can, what incentives can I put in place to start them?
I think it can go either way. I think the professional association one is more aligned with somebody's probably professional autonomy. They decide that as their identity, they want to be a math teacher, and so they join that organization. Although a policymaker could put in place things like incentives to belong to professional organizations, and that could be part of what contributed to one's ongoing credential or certification or something. So you could have policy You could use policy instruments for that. In California, in the math story, the state mandated the California subject matter projects, which were professional development projects all over the state in all the four content areas. So there were math projects all over the state, science projects all over the state, English projects all over the state, and they were developed in different kinds of ways, but largely what they were summer month-long experiences where teachers would work with disciplinary experts in the morning doing something, learning to write, learning to do history, learning more history, doing scientific inquiry, doing mathematics problems. And then they work in the afternoon with people who were experts in the development of curriculum and assessments, so that there was this dialectical collaboration between thinking about curriculum and learning the subject matter. And they were immersed in it for the summer. And then they would come back over the course of the year, maybe two or three times. And teachers would get paid to go to these subject matter institutes. And then the ones who really liked them would go back, or they would become instructors in them, or they would get hooked up with other kinds of organizations that were associated with those, like National Science Foundation projects or something like that. So I think in both cases, there's quite a lot that policy. I think that the power of them is that they feel grassroots, but there are supports that policymakers can put in place in order to make the grass grow faster.
And that was Suzanne Wilson from Michigan State University. In the course of the interview, Suzanne mentioned a professional development initiative at the American Museum of Natural History. And we'll put a link to that website on our programme website, insideed.com. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us on insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to my guest, Professor Suzanne Wilson, and to Barry Hennessy for the education news. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.